Welcome to this edition of the Not So Common Podcast. I'm Pat Contra, your host, and this week my guest is Gerard Khalil. He's a big time YouTuber with nearly 800,000 subscribers on his main channel, and his flagship show is The Completionist, which is also his moniker. Welcome, Gerard.
Hey, how's it going, Pat? Thanks for having me, man.
Thanks for finally coming on board here. We tried to set this up a while ago. You've been sick recently. Hope you're better. Are you running yourself ragged already, redoing all those episodes?
Yeah, I've been a little under the weather, but that just naturally comes with the wear and tear of being a human. You have to take some time for yourself to just kind of relax, and that's something that I definitely do not do.
Which has become a running theme from the YouTubers I've spoken to. And I'm starting to see more and more comments from people noticing that about, you know, like people, YouTubers saying, I work 7 days a week. I work 6 days a week. I haven't had a vacation in 4 or 5 years. And do you also see that with your colleagues or other YouTubers where it seems like there's a constant grind going on that's almost never ending?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, you know, because we have an office building filled with 9 to 11 YouTubers and streamers all together under one roof. And all of us, as a group, as a whole, feel that massive fatigue. But the nice thing is that we're there for each other, and we can, you know, we take the times for our personal lives for each other. So, for instance, we'll go to movies together, we'll go on vacations together, we'll do convention tours together, just as our means of, hey, let's get out of the office as a group and go do something fun.
So it's almost like going out for like a happy hour in a traditional office building. It's like, oh, let's all go out for drinks. We had a rough week. Let's all just at least hang out for a couple hours and sort of relax about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's our own little getaway for as little time as it may be.
I get that. So the insane work ethic that I see in you and other YouTubers, and probably sometimes myself, do you think that comes from just the level of competition on YouTube, where you can easily get lost if you don't put out constant content? People might forget about you in sort of the ADD internet age. Or is it really, does this sort of work attract the sort of, you know, hard worker that would traditionally in the past go towards other fields, and now this is what YouTube has attracted?
Well, I think it depends on what you're looking for. I think for me, it's a little bit of column A, column B, with a little bit of column C. And column C to me, and this is what Aaron, Igor, after, and I talk about a lot, is fuck you energy, which is like you kind of are. We're in this industry where people are constantly doubting you, criticizing you, making you feel bad, putting you down. And for me, I don't really see it as, you know, a personal attack so much as I see it as a, oh, you don't think I can do this crazy asinine thing? Well, then watch me do it. And so it's a combination of that mixed in with what YouTube has become as a never-ending ecosystem of content. The fact that the algorithms are constantly changing and punishing us as we, you know, get more successful or learn to go with the punches, if you will. On top of my own personal work ethic, I think it's a combination of those three things.
Well, what did you do for work before YouTube was full-time? Did you have a chance to get into the work world, or you were too young, you're really getting a chance to step in fully?
So, no. When I was 14, 15, I got my first job. I was working at a mom-and-pop cafe making espressos and lattes and sandwiches and stuff. It made a lot of – learned how to make a lot of tomato soup.
Tomato soup?
Yeah.
It wasn't out of a can there? It was from scratch?
It was from scratch.
Wow.
A lot of burns in my hands when I was younger.
Did you make the whipped cream little leaves in the top of the cappuccino?
Oh, absolutely. We had our own little like whipping machine on the side where for all the cream and stuff, and just had to perfectly puree the top of the tomato soup. So yeah, I worked there for a couple of years, and then from there, when I was 17, 18 years old, I got a job working for MySpace. That old little website that everyone used to work, that everyone used to love and use more so than Facebook. I worked there for 3 years in the data centers, and my responsibilities would be to rack and stack servers, configure them, cable them together. And my brother was one of the large tech arms of MySpace. He would be basically Tom Anderson's right-hand man. So if the website ever went down, or anything like that, chances are it was my brother who tweaked a setting who was freaking out. And so he and I worked closely together at the different data centers to make sure that servers would come online and communicate together and would handle a lot of the traffic. Because at one point, MySpace, believe it or not, was the biggest website on the earth. It was receiving more traffic than almost any website at one point. It was crazy.
You hear that, whippersnappers out there? Back in the 05 and the 04?
The 05, the 06, the 07.
That's so weird to say that because it's like over 10 years ago. I don't believe
it. I know.
That. So your brother worked for the Tom that was friends with everyone on MySpace when you first got your profile.
Correct.
And then he got you in on that because you were, if this was 11, 12 years ago, you were really young to be working in an IT department.
I was 17, 18 years old. I had a passion for building computers and just overall consumer electronics. And so my brother taught me at an early age because my dad, you know, runs his own, you know, local business, or not local business, but his own business. And my brother became an IT guy for my dad. And so he learned a lot about what he learned from that. And he used that as his skill when he went to go work for MySpace. And he quickly rose the corporate ladder at MySpace. But from a tech perspective, it never was a matter of making executive calls. He always was down in the data centers wearing cold jackets till 5 a.m. working his butt off. And I loved going with him to work. And eventually, after I'm a really quick learner, so I was able to pick up what he was doing physically. And then he would kind of teach me how to code and open terminal commands and start configuring the servers. And I did that for about 3 or 4 years while I was going to college.
So we're talking, you're starting off as a 17, 18-year-old working at MySpace, that young?
Yeah, I was working through a temp agency at the time, Adecco. You know, they like employ just, you know, you can go and companies can say, oh, we want temporary workers to do manual labor or computer processing or note-taking or whatever. And so I got in through there, and then once I worked through them, I officially got hired through Fox and through MySpace to continue doing my job as they fired the other temporary staff. And then I was there for about a year until I decided to really focus on school and just get my education out of the way.
But you were there for 3 years, though.
Yes, I was.
So little Gerard, high school Gerard, you're sitting there in high school in Palos Verdes, mm-hmm. and you're thinking, okay, I can go out and have fun. I could enjoy my high school years and my early college years. Instead, I want to get into the IT corporate world and work for a gigantic website. So even at that young age, you had an urge to do work, an urge to go out there and try to apply yourself early on.
Yeah, I would say it's true. I think I went to school for theater and film. I double majored. And so while I was getting my degrees, and really through high school, I was doing a lot of musical theater and acting for television and film and theater. And I was failing, mind you, because this is Los Angeles, so everyone doesn't get their big break, right?
Well, if you kept on it, you would have been the Josh Gad right now at this point,
yeah, right?
That would have been
right. But I, you know, the tech side was always my hobby, and my real passion was acting and film and creating in that aspect. And so, but the money was in the tech industry, and especially as someone who didn't know a lot about tech but was willing to learn and put in the hours, really I was learning from an early start that as long as you just keep putting yourself into what you're doing and practicing and learning and growing, then you can really do anything. And that was kind of my big takeaway from working at MySpace, was late night hours, but really appreciating all the stress that was there, because I learned so much about how to do all these cool different things.
So that's where you developed an earlier work ethic. But it sounds like, but from before that, it probably was instilled in you from your father running his own business, being an entrepreneur and doing that.
Yeah. So I'm the youngest of five. I have four siblings, one brother and three sisters, all of which either own their own businesses or work at a corporate company high on the ladder where they, you know, work their way up to that point where then they jumped that ship and made their own business or sold it or whatever they did with it. And so being the youngest of five is super hard, because especially in this environment, because my dad essentially was a single parent because my mom got Alzheimer's when I was 10. So it was one of those things where He was taking care of mom, and his business was thriving and growing, and we were all helping mom as well. On top of all of us having these high demanding jobs or responsibilities. And so at a young age, we all learned to just kind of roll with the punches and really commit to prioritizing and scheduling our lives to help each other out. So, you know, on top of being a full-time student and a theater nerd and a comedy sports nerd, loving video games and doing a job in MySpace, I was taking care of my mom full-time with my brother, who essentially was running MySpace, with my sister, who was getting her entrepreneur degree at USC, and my other sisters who started their own companies, and my dad. So we as a family have really learned to support each other and be there for one another as we're doing our own things. And that's always been our strongest suit as a family. My mom used to say to us, you know, one of us by ourselves, we're like a stick, right? We can break. But if we all bind together as a bundle, you can't break us. And that's always been kind of our family motto, is that we just stick together through all the bullshit and just really push through.
That's a beautiful saying, and that speaks to, obviously, the strength of family. I won't get into my familial issues, but it sounds like you had a nice core and foundation. And I can't imagine being that young with a mother going through early onset dementia. That just sounds terrifying at the same time, but it sounds like you guys banded together. So good on you guys for that. I can't imagine you guys. I mean, when I think about that part of the story with you, it almost seems like not necessarily that all the stuff you've done was an outlet to keep yourself busy, maybe, in some aspect, with all this going on, but it probably helped, at least, I'm guessing, relieve some of the strain and pressure and just, you know, emotional feelings, you know.
Oh yeah. When you... Everyone deals with tragedy and heartache and breakups and really just personal stuff in their own way, right? But I think what it all taught me with my mom and her illness was that, like, I can still be a normal person and still experience crazy things that happen. And I think everyone handles their own things differently. But that was the big urge for my dad, really, when I finally got into college. Because when I got to college, my dad told me, you know, now you're a man. You can go actually live your life for the first time. You don't have to come home. You can stay in your apartment. You have your own car. You have your own money. Like, you are an adult now. Don't feel tied to coming back to the family. Really find who you are and what you want to do with your life. And that was actually scary for me because, you know, I was, you know, for 8 or 9 years, I was with my family in high school doing all these extracurricular activities, taking all these AP courses and working in all these jobs. And then I got to high school, or I got to college, and all that was gone. And my only job was to be a student. And that freaked me the fuck out. That's why I went back to work at MySpace, because I was like, I don't know what to do. There's not enough for me to do.
That's really interesting. So you were saying you'd be bored at school.
Yeah.
Just sort of hang, go to class, you come home and study. What do you do with the other 8 hours of the day you got to fill, right? Once class is open at three or four. Wow, that's very interesting. And so from an earlier age, you had this sort of, I guess, desire to at least work and to be constructive at that age, while some of us had to develop that and basically force ourselves to do that and sort of get to that point. I mean, I thought it was bad just having my crappy job in the mall when I was in college. You know, in the summer, I thought that was a hassle. You know, just working at I worked at Suncoast Motion Picture Company, where they sold still VHSs, but also some DVDs that were new at the time. So did this, this quote unquote fuck you energy that I've never heard it expressed that way before, but it makes sense. And I haven't spoken to Aaron in a long time. Now, when somebody I talked to him, I really have to ask him about that specifically. This is separate from your own work ethic, but this sort of, I guess, builds upon it. Like, you already have a nice foundation of, okay, I'm going to work hard. I'm going to get myself out there. I'm going to handle the stress. But now you have an extra desire built in based upon naysayers and competition. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I've never really been a competitive person in regards to being the best. I've actually been the exact opposite. I've always looked at competition and you know, everyone's like, how do I be number one, number two, number three? And I've never really tried to live that way. I've always just tried to be like, how do I be different? How do I stand out? How do I get honorable mention? How do I make people walk away remembering who I am and what I've done? And that's where a lot of that fuck you energy comes from, because My family has always been so supportive, right, in telling me what to do and supporting me and living my dreams. And then I meet other friends or other like-minded individuals who have been like, you can't do that. That's crazy. Why would you do that to yourself? That sounds awful. Don't do that. And that mere fact of someone saying, don't do that, that's a bad idea or that's stupid, that's always upset me because that just means that I should, like, that's like give up before you started, you know? And I can't. I have to try. I have to give it my best before I walk away from something.
So even if someone came to you and said, this is nuts, don't do this, out of not even out of hatred, out of love, they thought they were helping you by telling you not to do something, you still took that as sort of a challenge, a sort of like kick in the butt to actually go out and do it harder than maybe you would have before.
Yeah, absolutely. When I started doing The Completionist specifically, one of my buddies, Zan, who is a good friend of mine, he just was like, man, I love you. You work, you put your heart and soul into everything, and I want you to do well, but you are crazy for doing what you do and thinking it's going to work. And I looked at him and I was like, I appreciate your concern, and I know that it's pretty insane, but I think I can do it, and I'm going to make it work. And fast forward to 6 years now, six years next Friday, and I've been doing this for six damn years, and that's crazy to think about.
That's kind of funny because someone we mutually know that we might have discussed before in Norway said something similarly to me. I quit my soul-crushing day job back in 2012, so it's been a little over 5 years. But I didn't have any sort of success on YouTube at all for probably a year and a half, 2 years after that. I was almost starting from zero income at that point. He said something similar. He said, are you sure you want to do that? Do you think that's a smart idea to do that? Basically doubting me. And not that that gave me an extra push, but I think it just showed that there are some people out there that, for rightly or wrongly, don't lack the same confidence in something that you want to do or your dreams or something you want to push yourself to. And I think that's why when you take advice from people, you should listen to them, but take everything with a grain of salt. And this isn't me saying to you, obviously, but to everyone else listening to this, that not saying that there isn't something that you can say to someone that would make sense, like, oh, I want to be an astronaut. Okay, well, how are you going to do that? Are you in the military? Are you in flight school? What's your path? Like asking questions like that, if I want to be an astronaut, that makes sense. But for something that's a little more open-ended, like what we're doing, maybe have some faith in it, you know, in yourself to at least, like you said, at least try it and see if you fail at it first. Give it the old college try, right?
Hey, man, life is about showing up. Like 90% of what you do is about showing up. If you just show up, great. The other 10% is up to you. And I think a lot of people just don't show up. You know, I've been working on this thing for a long time. All right, cool. It's been 9 months. Where is it at? Like you have to, the big thing I always tell people who start out doing YouTube is you have to fail and you have to fail hard and you have to fail big so you can learn what worked and what didn't and how to do it better and how to better yourself. And those are elements that people just don't think about. They see the end result. They see the end and they go, that's where I want to be. But they don't see the work and the hardship in between. And I think it's all about you have to commit. You have to dive in head first and get your hands dirty and learn to grow and fail. And failure is such a bad thing, right? When you hear the word fail, it's like it instills this weird thing of, oh, that's a bad connotation. But no, you need to. You need to grow, and you need to learn how to grow from those experiences, or else you're not going to be able to go where you want to go.
Yeah, I think that's the key word you said. I don't look at anything on YouTube as failure. It's growth.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, the majority of YouTubers, especially those starting out, are one-man armies, right? We are entrepreneurs to some degree. It varies between person to person. We are our own writers, actors, you can say, voice actors. It can be editors, producers, you know, our own PR people at the same time. So when people ask me or they come up to me and they say something like, I have this idea, but I'm not sure what I should do with it. I've been thinking about doing this thing for months. The first thing I say to them is you have to at least do something. You have to have a starting place like anything else. Like there's a reason why they have TV pilots. where you have to at least put something on paper or on film to see if it works. Is this a direction I want to go? I'm sure if you go back and watch your earliest videos, you'd be like, ooh, I wouldn't do that again. And the same with me. Well, first I'd learn how to light a room in my earlier videos. But, you know, but there, I can't watch probably the first two, even maybe 3 years of videos I've done, because I know I've grown since then. But everyone has those baby steps, right? Everyone has that sort of place where you crawl before you walk, before you run. And maybe this brings up the point, kind of the fuck you energy before, about the feedback. Maybe some people are afraid of bad feedback or negative responses because you are putting yourself out in the public eye when you're on YouTube. And maybe you can speak to that a little bit about if that's something you've thought about or maybe it's not something that affects you.
Oh, man. In the early days as The Completionist, I would do the most – I took my film and theater degree and I used it as an analytical sense of how to determine data. So what I would do – and I kind of got this from MatPat in the early stages. He and I were talking early on when our careers first started. And a lot of what I did was I'd make a new video and I would then personally print out the first 36 hours worth of content. Of comments in massive charts, and then I would take a highlighter and I would highlight all of the ones that were positive, all of the ones that were negative, all of the ones that were in the middle, and all the ones that were criticism. And so I was able to look at this
in different colors, though.
Different colors. Yes. Okay. And I was able to look at this green, red, orange, yellow highlighted chart that showed me what my audience was thinking. And I did this for, I think, the first 10 episodes of The Completionist, because I, as much as I was making content and learning and growing, I needed to learn what the audience early on was thinking and saying. And eventually, I stopped doing that because I stopped seeing the changes in the growth. Like, I realized that at this, you reach a point where the YouTube comments based on Google+ and the evolution of YouTube and analytics, most of them favor negative interactions. So no matter what, no matter how big I got or how small I was, the negative comments always outweighed the positive. And there was no way at that point that I could try and counterbalance my content to meet those negative needs, because a lot of the comments were contradictory and didn't really know what they were talking about, or, you know, and so I had to take a step back and go, okay, I think I have done as much as I can to craft what my content to match what the general user base wants to see. And then you start to really look at the big picture of, well, if this video has 100,000 views but only has 1,000 comments, that's, you know, what, 10%, 1% of the people that are watching and actually commenting and engaging in your content. And so that percentage gets bigger and bigger and smaller on both ends, where the more views I get on the video, the more comments I got. But a lot of those comments were never really about my content so much as they didn't like the way that I sounded. They didn't like the way that I looked. They racially didn't like me, or, you know, they thought my views on this one video was really bad and it ruined their image of me going forward. And you get to that point where that aspect of catering your content just stopped working really, really quickly. And so I learned a lot, but it's something that I still read the comments as much as I can nowadays. And it's hard because the comments are more vicious than ever. But yeah, it was a good experience, and I'm glad I did it. I'm glad that I learned from it and committed to it.
I don't want to seize on one word you said during your delivery there, but you did bring up the word catering. So early on, you obviously wanted to put out a video content that people wanted to see. But do you think that you were hung up too much on trying to put out exactly what people wanted to see and to sort of sacrifice what you thought you would enjoy putting out? Or are you just trying to use catering more as a nudging towards what people you think would enjoy overall in order to have them engage more overall and come back?
I think it's more of a nudging tool. Like, it's not like I was changing my content or my principles because I was insecure in my feelings or opinions. It was more of learning, you know, one of my key – I feel like every year when I look back at a new season of The Completionist, I kind of look back and I go, how do I – what did I learn this year? What can I change differently? And this year, for me, my theme has been I can say the same thing I want without sounding a certain way. There, the sentence, this game fucking sucks, versus this game's a little rough around the edges, is way different. And the audience likes to commit either way. They want it to be this or that. And so I've learned, that's something that I've learned, is that I can still say this game is not good without being an asshole, without being aggressive. And that's something that, you know, again, I've picked up on that this year. And I think when it comes to your audience, it's important to take everything with a grain of salt, like we said earlier.
I don't know if you were with your thought.
No, go.
You're talking about minor tonal shifts in writing and in delivery of the same thought, basically. Saying in the past, maybe if you were rougher in certain terms, some of your audience wouldn't respond to that or like that, but you felt you can get the same point across by being a little more smooth or maybe more quote-unquote professional, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think time and place is important too, right? Like, if a game really sucks, I can actually speak openly about it. But if a game is controversial, where it's good but bad or bad but good and everyone's down the middle, that's where, you know, really everyone's looking at you. You know, I loved Yooka-Laylee even though everyone hated it. So I got a lot of scrutiny for being the one guy in the world that actually liked that game. So, you know,
you were the one person.
Now, there were a lot more. But, you know, there's that aspect of it's almost like wrestling, right? Everyone wants to see what YouTuber is on their favorite, like on their favorite. Are they a heel this week or are they a babyface? But you take those two things and you're like, but we're fucking people. Like, that's not really a thing to really worry about.
We're not just personas, right? We're actually human beings.
Yeah, and that's something that's always scary, right? Is sometimes you go to conventions and you meet people and they talk to you like you're a YouTube video, and it's like, I can actually hear what you're saying. Like, that's inappropriate. That's rude.
I remember one story in particular. We're getting sidetracked, but I think it was in SDC where you came up to me pretty upset because there was some person there. I want to say it was SGC 2013 or 14, where they're like, yeah, they came up to me, were really, really rude, and they're bothering me. I remember saying to you, hey, do you want me to take care of this? Because you were pretty upset, I remember, at the time. I don't know if you remember that story or not.
Yeah, I remember it, and I think – I don't remember what the context was, what the person said, but I definitely remember feeling that way because – I'm usually pretty good at being like, well, thanks for coming anyways, bye. But it just takes that one person just to get under my skin, and it's like freaking symbiote style. Like, I'm like, ugh, I feel sick.
do you feel you encounter that more than other YouTubers, about people come up to you and feel the need, or they feel they can be more open about either disliking or disagreeing with something you did in a past video?
Prior to the Greg stuff, that never happened. That happened, like, I think that's why it hit me so hard when it did.
It'd be rare.
Yeah, it would be really rare. Maybe one out of every 18 conventions I went to, someone would say something like that. And then after everything happened with Greg, that would happen three or four times a convention, and that's. That at that point, I just learned how to pivot, and that was really weird because I just didn't know how to respond. But yeah, it was definitely really bizarre.
In terms of the Greg stuff, was it just comments that they disagree with you, or they now hated you because of what went down?
They hated me with what went down. They almost, like, it's like a peaceful protest to my face. Like, I don't watch your videos anymore because he's not there and he was the reason why I watched, and you're not funny anymore and you're not good and I think you suck. And it's like, and all I would say was, sorry you feel that way, thanks for watching, best of luck. Like, and that would get under their nerves because
they couldn't get a rise out of me.
And I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't give that to them.
That's interesting. I'm never sure. I think I might have had a couple of comments like that, like, to my face, but usually they're a little more jokey, I would say, in terms of going after me for something I said in a video. But, like, I could tell there was some good humor underneath it. But you're saying in these cases it was just directly hostile and just basically the vocal version of a YouTube comment that they might type out.
Yeah. And those who would come up and say, like, a snarky comment like that in regards to a game or an opinion, you could tell from a mile away that it was such a joke. It was such, mm-hmm. they were having fun with the video that I made, and they were having fun with me in real time. And those moments I love, because it's like, you know, I love really bad games, or I hate games that are really popular. And so, you know, someone will be like, how could you hate this game? And I'm like, oh, that's just my opinion. And we have a nice joke. But those kinds of comments, those types of comments definitely disappeared over the years as the more drama-filled ones started flying at me.
Which I think is interesting, that I think on average, though, these sort of negative interactions would just go up, just because from what I've seen of you, and I even gave you shit for this, I see you kill yourself at conventions for your fans. And this isn't me kissing your ass, but I've seen you at probably at least half a dozen conventions where...
Well, don't doubt yourself, Pat, because you're... If I'm busting ass, so are you. You're the one selling them books, and you're in the thick of it.
No. Here's the difference. You have about four times the subscribers as me. So that means that means four times the amount of people show up to see you on average versus me. I will see you just walking around the floor with like it's like a scene from like a Beatles movie with like 20 people around you, and you're just constantly taking pictures and talking and signing stuff while you're walking, to your credit, and you have a big smile on your face, and I'll see you at the beginning of the day, then I won't see you for like 3 hours, and then I'll see you nearly passed out, like dead tired by the end of the day. And I'll be like, Gerard, what the hell happened? Like, yeah, it went on for like 2 hours longer than I thought it would. And I'm just like, son of a bitch, Gerard, you got to take a break at some point, right? I mean, you're only human.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I at a convention, I feel like the vibes are so fun and positive, and everyone's so happy to be there. And so I want to also be as happy as they are to see me as then when I see them. And I feel like I do a pretty good job with that. I feel like some conventions, depending on where I am, sometimes I'll be fully in like that mode, and other times I'll be like, I'm going to be Hollywood and hide in my hotel room.
Yeah, I guess if you have I think we talked about earlier in the year your insane convention schedule this year, where it was like what almost every week for like a couple months at some point. It was
from April until July. I had a convention, or it was either a convention, a video like brand deal, which involved me flying out to a company's location in a different state, or I was at a personal event that was like in a different country, and that was all back to back to back for I think it was 15 weeks straight.
And you still managed to put out videos.
Yep. Every Friday Completionist came out, every Beard Bros every day.
You son of a bitch, this work ethic. So you're going to these conventions, you're jet lagged, and I know because I've seen it. We roomed together in Norway, we can talk about that. And you're recording freaking voiceovers after the convention at night. You're sitting there, you're like, Pat, do you mind? I got to record some voiceover to go to sleep. Yeah. I'm like, Gerard, you're a machine. I can't stop you anyway. If I said, screw you, you would punch me and do it anyway. But I see you do this. It's not bullshit. I know you have a team that helps you, but you still are working as you're traveling. What is that like when you feel like, because conventions to me are still work in some respects. I mean, people have gotten on me where it's like, oh, how bad can it be? You're flying around and going to these conventions. Like, it's actually work still. It's not like it takes a lot of energy out of you. And obviously, we choose this life. But tell me about that. Like, do you feel sometimes at these conventions like, oh, my God, I made a mistake? Just not necessarily because you have to talk to 1,000 fans, or just because there's no downtime at all even, because you're still on a constant schedule.
You know, I feel like if you asked Gerard that question from 2 years ago, it'd be different from asking me now. Because 2 years ago when... everything did go down. I think I booked like 14 conventions, and my train of thought was, if I see people, they'll be happy that I'm around, that I'm showing up, that I'm still a part of the show, that I'm still there for the fans. And the crowds were bigger, obviously, because my channel blew up in 2015. 2015 was the year that my channel tripled in size. It was tough. That was super tough because, again, those were negative comments were flying at me hardcore, and there was nothing I could do to pivot. But 2016, 2017, with Big Bad Bosses and my personal channel launching and The Completionist really taking a bigger strides to tell a more narrative as opposed to a review, I saw these changes and it made me feel so much – I felt happier because I was kind of in control of what I was doing again. As a YouTuber, as I've learned, and I'm sure as you've learned too, Pat, when you make these videos, YouTube favors them differently depending on tags, depending on names, depending on your content. Is it long form? Is it short form? And you kind of get into this routine of constantly getting ready to pivot your entire career based on a stupid code. And I think – traveling to me has made it all worth it because I can just say, you know what, at the end of the day, screw the code, screw YouTube, screw everything there. I'm here in this convention, in this city, in this state, in this country for these people. And that to me is so much more fun. And yes, it is work. There's autographs, there's merch to sell, there's things to sign, there's all this stuff. But I think it definitely is worth it.
So you saw this, these working, not even working vacations, these work weekends as a respite from the demands of YouTube.
Correct.
So even though you're still working during those weekends and maybe editing in your hotel room after a 7-hour convention day, you're getting away for part of that. It's something different. When you said in 2015 you didn't feel in control of what you were doing, was that because of stuff that went down with Greg or something else that was happening at the same time?
It was a little bit of both. So for the first half of the year with the Greg stuff, I had to pivot my content almost entirely. How do I make people want to stick around for a show that no longer has this sidekick character? And
not as jokey, not as overly humorous. Yes.
Yeah, and it focused more about the heart and soul of the game itself and the conversation. I put in all my chips on people loving video games over my own personality and my own investment. And the show changed a lot, and the first few months were a little rough for everyone, both behind the scenes and for the audience. But come September and October, I had made awesome videos like Pepsi Man, which is like, you know, something I'm very popular for, and my Mario Maker series and my Mario Maker video. Those videos in 2015 were some of my best, because they highlighted my strengths as a completionist and my investment in the show. And then at the end of October, as my channel, according to my analytics and the way I was growing the channel and the way I was creating content, I had a good idea of how I wanted to make the show and what I wanted to go with it. The end of October, YouTube released YouTube Red. And that changed all of the algorithmic growth that I had. I went from a channel that was going to be hitting 1 million subscribers by the end of the year to a channel that got 60,000 subscribers over the case of 7 months. And it was like hitting this massive roadblock where I was making this show that I loved, that was growing, that was doing really well, and it just stopped working. The YouTube algorithms just stopped favoring my channel. And while I was getting the views on the newer videos, my older backlog wasn't growing. I wasn't gaining subscribers. I wasn't gaining growth. And it forced me to reevaluate my content and go, what the frick is going on here? And that was stressful for a good 9-10 months.
So within one calendar year, you go from, you're getting more success, you go through this schism with Greg, the channel then blows up. You have to redefine your own content. You see it moving in a huge, huge direction, subscriber growth wise, and then it gets, you think, cut off at the knees because of YouTube Red. So, was that discouraging, or did you sort of take it in stride? Because obviously, the algorithms benefited you for a while to have this really rapid subscriber and view growth, and now it getting cut off. That really put a damper on your spirits at that point.
Oh, absolutely. I was ready to call it in. I think I was done. I was really over everything about YouTube at that point. I went from having the highest of my high in career to my lowest, back to the highest, back to the lowest. It was crazy. And I think what really made me resurface myself as a content creator for 2016 was the album that I made for Big Bad Bosses. When we made that album and pushed it out there, it was my own e-commerce. It was my own way of saying, hey, I made this thing that has nothing to do with YouTube. It's independent of the content that I create. It's very fucking different. It's not, you know, it's like your book. It's not your content. It's this different thing that you've created, right? And so I doubled down and I made this album, and the success of the album was so large financially for me and the team and everyone who worked on the album that in 2016, I took 6 months to reevaluate my content. How do I change it? How do I grow it? Do I adapt it to the YouTube algorithms? You know, do I look at the data? And so I was able to really relax early on in 2016 and kind of go, how do I change this? How do I make it feel more fun? How do I get control back of my content? And I'm glad that I did that because the first half of 2016 was really rough for me. I was feeling super uninspired. I was feeling sluggish, you know.
You were feeling sluggish because the growth wasn't as great, but weren't you still getting pretty good views on your videos?
Yeah, I mean, I was getting okay views, and I think what people see views on videos externally, right, and they look at it and they go, oh, that's a lot of views, but what they don't see is the retention, they don't see the data behind each video, they don't see the comments, likes, dislike ratios behind the scenes and what it does to each channel, and the tags, and the thumbnails, and YouTube... In today's ecosystem, YouTube is no longer about content. Content is no longer king. It is about how to advertise your content based on the current platform. And that current platform is consistently pivoting every single month. And you can see it in these rise of YouTubers that no one's ever heard of. You know, a YouTuber goes from having 100,000 subs to, you know, 15 million in literally 6 to 8 months. And it's because they figured out how to game the system. You know, drama YouTubers, prime example, things like Keemstar and those guys. They all learned that by using words like exposed, disturbing, disgusting, tagging it with all their videos of all the YouTubers in those videos, they've learned to algorithmically charge the YouTube algorithm to favor them. And so content almost is unimportant nowadays, which is super discouraging. And that's been the one thing that I've been so keen on is I want this content to stay the best. I want to do the best version of it, but how do I keep doing what I do and keep growing the way I want to grow when the YouTube algorithms are saying, stop doing what you're doing, it's not working, you're not growing?
Well, but isn't that comes down to art, though, correct? I mean, what is this? What are we putting out? What are we creating? Are we doing something that we know is gaming some sort of mathematical equation on Google's back end, or are we producing content that we like, that we know other people are liking still years later, but maybe it's not kicking in that ignition factor in order to get this end over end subscriber growth? And I think that's the question I've asked myself in the past, because I knew what was popular on YouTube years back. I knew if I started doing lots of different other content, like when top 10 videos were extremely popular, for example, I knew I could do that. But is my heart into it? Is that something that I can look back on and say, I'm proud of that work? Or is that something I know that I'm just going to cash in the short term? So this isn't advice. This is me just stating what I believe, is that even if I never got into that sort of, by luck or by faking it, got into that algorithm role that others have enjoyed, can I still be satisfied with what I've done? Can I still look back at what I've done and say, you know what? That's good work. I know people like it. I know it because they're still sticking around. I know that because, you know, conventions still ask me out to talk about my content, and I know people are going to stay with me. I know my Twitter followers still like what I'm handing out there, goofiness, likewise. So maybe that's where I come back to with that. Maybe I look at, like you said, maybe there are YouTubers that got 10 million subscribers in 1 year. Does that mean, though, 2 years from now, when things are in their favor, they're still going to be around doing what they're doing to the same extent? I don't know.
Right. The difference between that content and our content is you can take our content and you can put it on a DVD. You can put it on a television show. You can put it on a showcase. You can put it in a museum. You can put it somewhere where someone who doesn't necessarily know the content they're watching is a show format that's long form, that actually has highs and lows and has overall editing and feel to it. Whereas if you take a drama video or a news video on a YouTuber, you can't take that and put that on television. You can't take that and put it on Amazon or Netflix. You can't take those kinds of content, even Let's Plays, for example. You can't take a Let's Play and throw it on TV, even though Disney's doing that. You can't really do that and have it be this content that not only you're proud of, but one that's going to reflect like this time capsule of content. When we make the videos that we make, you can watch them and you can clearly see, oh, this is not only a review or a retrospective or even things like the video game years, which I know you've put your passion into, which I love. it's this behind the scenes aspect of like the times of the games and who was there and all this stuff. That's all stuff that you can say, I'm proud of this. People can watch and people can consume it. The other content you can't on a massive global scale.
Well, it's fast food. It's fast food versus a fine gourmet dinner. That's the way. I mean, you watch a drama video. It's potato chips. It's there. It's greasy. It's slimy. It's easy to put down a bunch of them. But yeah, you're gonna look back a couple years from now. Why did I eat all those potato chips?
Yeah.
And who's gonna go back and remember those chips you had back then? That particular package of Doritos. But yeah, it works though for now. It's like TMZ. That's the way I look at, you know, that sort of genre. And yeah, and they might fall out of favor. I don't know if the apocalypse hits certain genres of videos more than others, where, yeah, maybe you get a lot of views, but it really doesn't do much in terms of your revenue, so they got to get out of it. I'm not going to get out of what I'm doing right now. I've never made a ton of money doing the videos I've done, but I make enough that I can still do it, if that makes sense, you know, and that keeps me going. And stuff like video game years is something that I always bemoan the time that went into it, but yeah, I can look back at it and be proud of it, even if I knew it never found an audience on YouTube. I think Jared one time tweeted out, this is the best YouTube show no one knows about. So it's a bittersweet feeling, but at least I can say, yeah, I did that. It's cool. You know, it's there. This is turning into a plug for watch Video Game Years on Amazon Prime. It's on.
Yo, you all – no shit. You all should. It's so good.
I appreciate that. So what you're talking about also, though, is, I guess, legacy. What legacy do you want to leave behind in your content, correct? Like, 10 years from now, how do you want to be remembered? Is that in your current content how you think about it? Do you look towards the future in terms of what am I, 10 years from now, what am I going to be doing? How am I going to be building myself off my current brand? Or how is this going to evolve into how others view me, other business relationships?
Absolutely. I firmly believe that, especially in today's digital age, whenever you make anything, whether it's a tweet or a Facebook post or a Reddit post or, in this case, content on YouTube or Vimeo or Twitch, whatever it may be, you have a digital footprint of what anyone can find of you. And whether you're a jerk online or you're someone who likes to passionately create, you have a legacy to leave behind you in some regard. And if you have that popularity, I think it kind of behooves us to put a little bit more effort into what we create. I think we almost have a responsibility to try and entertain if that's what you want to do. And I think legacy is very important. And I think it's something that a lot of YouTubers don't think about. I think they're kind of in this mindset of, well, I've got 15 minutes to capitalize off of this, so I'm going to take those 15 minutes and crash and burn. Or I'm going to take a step back and see what I can do to keep this 15 minutes, go another 15 minutes. And I think it's super important that people don't really think about.
Well, it's short-term versus long-term outlook, correct?
Absolutely.
Where it's like, what can I do now? I know this is the hot trend, going back to like drama videos, because that's the big thing now. Like, I know this is the hot trend. I know I can get big just reporting on other YouTubers like an online TMZ. But 3 years from now, what's that going to, like, what is that going to get me? Is that going to open any doors? Is that going to expand to other possible content? That's how I have to look at these sort of decisions and things like that. You know, I really do. But yeah, Video Game Years, that's opened a little bit of doors just because people at least respect it, even if no one's seen it. I actually had someone tell me this, and this isn't me bragging about it, but something happened recently when I told someone about a project that I was working on behind the scenes, that someone told me, is like, yeah, I didn't think much of it, but then I heard you were involved in it, you meaning me in this case, and I was like, huh, that's interesting. Did I build up some sort of weird cachet by working on various projects over the years? Does this mean more versus just views, I guess, or revenue coming in currently? Is what you're outputting, is it some sort of weird respect level you're growing that's not necessarily parallel with subscriber growth and views? And maybe that's where we're getting at too, where YouTube is becoming, I always argue, it's more important or just as important as a means versus an end. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
I've never viewed YouTube as the end platform, you know? I've always thought of it as a stepping stone. I've always tried to create a TV show on YouTube. Whether it be The Completionist or my old content that no one watches anymore that you have to try and find. I've always been...
You just search out for it specifically. Yeah, yeah, Gerard's old ass videos.
They're there. They're there. But I think what I found myself doing was I wanted to try and create a platform or a thing to the next step. You know, I'm a filmmaker. I'm a storyteller. I want to make documentaries. I want to make behind the scenes, you know, info stuff. Like Norm, the gaming historian, makes the content I've always wanted to make. His stuff is so freaking good that that's kind of where I always wanted to see myself on a more professional, grander scale, where people can consume that content. Norm did it, and that's why I love Norm so much, because you know that's what he does so good. You know, Satchel Drakes of Satchback's Goods, he had these great videos too, and Javed, Good Blood Games, these guys create this content that is not meant for an audience other than the one that's currently watching. They're made for like a Netflix, an Amazon, a general consumer standpoint. And I think YouTube is not about that. YouTube is about curation of types of content. You have your gaming YouTubers, you have your beauty vloggers, you have your musicians, you have your live stream gamers, which is different from your gamers. You have these different subsidiary groups. And to me, YouTube has never been the platform to end it all. It's what you said. It's always been a means. It's never been an end. And I think that from a financial income standpoint, YouTube has done all but help the creators in regards to making the correct turns and pivots they need to transform the platform, whether it's moving on to something like a YouTube Red produced show or moving off the platform somewhere else. The platform is too large to give a shit about everyone as a whole, and that's kind of their own fault.
Well, curated content. I mean, we're talking about different levels of content. Someone gets a webcam, they get their mic, they can make a video and upload it in 10 minutes versus something that takes a team or is well produced, like you put out still weekly content, which boggles my mind how that's possible to do that. Or something like James Rolfe doing AVGN, Norm doing The Gaming Historian, video game year, stuff where it takes a lot of behind-the-scenes time, and time equals money, mm-hmm. obviously. And it's become more and more apparent that YouTube is not the place to... Maybe not, you can put it on YouTube, but that's not where you're going to display it and show it off in order to, quote-unquote, I guess, get your, quote-unquote, money and time back for the production costs, for the time it takes. Because people worry about, well, who cares about making money? Well, time is money, because if you don't recoup those costs, you don't have the time to do that, because you have to do another job in order to pay the mortgage and to eat. You know, so that's what it comes down to. But I do love the fact that Amazon Prime now accepts people uploading content. But it's very specific. It's not gonna be YouTube content, and so far it isn't. They're only gonna accept and probably focus and spotlight highly well produced content, you know, serialized content. So to me, that's another outlet that's coming that maybe Blip tried and failed to do, but Amazon has the money behind it where they can make it lasting, for example. So I'm happy that while it's not gonna ever be a competitor directly to YouTube, it's another outlet for online creators to look at for the future.
I think we're at a tipping point right now where YouTube doesn't know what they want to do with YouTube. And I think they look at things like Netflix and Amazon Prime Video and they see themselves as we can be that. And the reality is they already were that. They already were the Hollywood aspects that these companies have been striving to do. They just didn't know how to package it or didn't know how to present it. And so that's when things like YouTube Red, which is a really bad name for their platform.
Which, by the way, they still don't advertise anywhere. I think I've seen one commercial or two in the past year and a half for it.
I know a lot of friends who are making YouTube Red shows, and the amount of bullshit that goes beyond the construction of those shows is so fascinating. They don't even have a budget for advertising. And it's like, you have YouTubers in the shows. That's your advertising arm. Like, it's not
bizarre.
Hard. It's not hard.
or how about this? This is a free, YouTube Red, I'm doing your work for you. This is free YouTube Red content and also free promotional tool with a small kickback. What if they give – not this is to be every YouTuber, but YouTubers that have proven their salt that are quote-unquote verified. I think I'm verified. You are. You know, ones that aren't just fly by night.
Yeah.
Give us the ability to do Red exclusive content on our channel and then with some sort of kickback to us if we get people to sign up for it. Doesn't everyone win at that point?
Yeah. Because
we get the word out about YouTube Red, which is a great product if it's only $10 a month. Or when YouTube TV comes along and if they package it with that to everyone. They get free YouTube Red content, or at least they're not paying for the production costs. They give us a kickback for people we get there, and it's an organic way of growing it because then YouTubers can use it as little or as much as they want to and not be forced to. If I'm a YouTube Red person, what if I see all that exclusive content and I don't care about any of it? What if I see someone doing a show? It's like, well, I never watched that content in my life. I'm not going to sign up just for that. You know, I think they're at a weird spot where, like you said, they're going out to try to compete with a Netflix. But I don't think they realize that like when Netflix is paying out the ass for all this exclusive content, they already have figured out their return on that investment beforehand. I don't think they know what's happening with that YouTube Red content. Like, it's very telling that without almost a second thought, they went and canceled that PewDiePie second season YouTube Red show at the drop of a hat. I'm not sure they would have done that if they knew the first season was a massive success and getting new Red subscribers to it. That was just a very telling moment to me that they're still throwing crap against the wall, I think, when it comes to this platform. Like, maybe, I don't know if you agree with that.
I'm with you 100%. And I think that my biggest gripe with YouTube Red is how the payout system works. It encourages competition. Like, for instance, Pat the NES Punk fans who are listening to this, if you have YouTube Red and you want to give Pat your $10 of YouTube Red, that means you can only watch Pat the NES Punk. You have to watch Pat the NES Punk consistently for 1 month straight and only Pat the NES Punk in order for him to receive your $10.
Sounds good to me. Guys, do it.
Well, on the global scale, right, the idea is, well, if I'm subscribed to 100 YouTubers and I'm watching them all together evenly, then you take 100 YouTubers or whatever and you split that, you know, $10 pie any way you want. People are going to make 50 cents a user or 25 cents a user. And that's fine, right? If there's enough people doing that. But the reality is that people are buying YouTube Red to get rid of the ads for the most part. So they have a ad-free experience on YouTube, which, let's be real, the ads are intrusive. And two, they want to watch that content only for that user that they want to support. You know, if you want to support MatPat or the Game Grumps show, both shows I actually like and I think they're some of the best on the platform so far. But it's not enough because after you watch that content, you can be like, well, that was fun. Click unsubscribe. And now you have watched that content and now it is gone. You know, like,
well,
it's a weird zone. It's a very weird zone that does not inspire. It just creates this weird cloud of weird economy.
It's a weird economy, e-commerce. But overall, it is a positive YouTube Red because the amount of ads that the split that is going towards the creators, I think it's like, what is it? Is it $4 or $5 out of the 10 that goes towards the creators? You're not going to watch, any user is not going to watch $5 worth of ads in 1 month anyway. It's going to be a lot less than that. So overall, the net win is for the YouTuber, content creator still.
Correct.
However, to your point, there should be something like with Twitch where if I sign up, I say, well, this person got me to sign up or this is my preferred YouTuber. So they get a somewhat larger cut or they get a bonus. That makes a lot of sense. I don't care if it's 20 cents a month, you know, just something like that to incentivize, again, you promoting it. Otherwise, what's your incentive to promote YouTube Red directly? Do you have one?
No.
You know, I don't have one.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't give a shit about YouTube Red.
Well, the other positive, though, that is that those ad pools from that user that sign up get back into the get thrown into the bag, the larger pool of YouTube ads to be filled, because the not dirty secret is that there's not enough ads to go around per views. There just isn't.
Not only that, but YouTube Red is not supported internationally. So how are users across the world, which, by the way, we've been to international conventions. There are a lot more international folks that go to a convention than local state folks do. And that's because... Mm-hmm. the international folks are more ravenous. They're more like, I want to see this person because this person's coming from the States and they want to support that person. A lot of my Patreon and GameWisp users are from different countries and they're happy to support us on those platforms because they feel like they're personally contributing. And those are the guys that we really appreciate versus like, oh, well, they have to buy YouTube Red. Oh, and they can't use YouTube Red, or they have to buy the platform, the content per episode on YouTube Red. And it's like, then decide, is it on demand or is it a streaming platform? You can't be both.
Sure. Yeah, I was kind of surprised by the first couple of NES charity marathons just to see the number of donations that came in from Europe, most notably Scandinavian nations. And again, that happened with the first real merchandise I ever had was my first DVD, which was, I think, came out 4 years ago. And I was shocked by the proportion of overseas European sales of the DVD. It was a much larger percentage than the percentage of those people watching the videos. So I was like, wow, yeah, they want to support. They want to find a way. Maybe it's a cultural thing. I don't know, but they want to find a way to support us.
Yeah.
And it's just give them a reasonable way to do it, and I think they would sign up and do it. You know, make YouTube Red accessible. Like I said, give creators an incentive to want to sign people up. And I'm still shocked they haven't figured that out. You know, two years in to YouTube Red? And
yeah.
they still haven't figured that out. That should have been figured out rolling it out. So I know the YouTube TV might incorporate some aspects or try to do that with YouTube Red. It really should. They should bundle them up together. But yeah, figure it out. Help us out here, YouTube. This isn't going to come a YouTube rant at all, is it? I hope not.
I actually got offered to pitch several YouTube Red shows, and all of my pitches they did not like.
Really?
Yeah, they were like, these are all bad. And I'm like, oh, interesting. Okay.
Are you at liberty to share any for fun?
We'll see. I'm still in the one of them. I'm still in the talks of pitching to Amazon. Or another platform. I might just pitch it to a TV network. Yeah, it's unfortunate because YouTube was like, let's have a sit down meeting, and so I had the meeting and I pitched, and they were like, well, we'll get back to you. And I'm like, oh, okay. So this was you guys just didn't read the room. I didn't read the room very well. Okay, sorry about that. And
how did that feel at the time? It was like pitching to a Hollywood studio movie. And you're like, ooh, that was my opportunity. It got crushed.
Well, not only that, but you'd assume that like
they work with you, give you feedback.
Not even that, but like YouTube is the platform. You know, I would thought they would know my content. I thought they'd know my audience and know what I was trying to create and do. And it was one of those things where I pitched a couple of ideas. And then they came out with me and they pitched me two ideas that were nothing like my content. And I'm like, why would I make something that my audience would not want to see? I want to make stuff that I want to see.
So you think that they were just applying what maybe had worked for other YouTubers to you without knowing who or what you did? So they basically just called you in because they saw your subscriber count.
Well, that's the funny thing is that that was during my trajectory of getting to 1 million subs in a year. And so they were like, oh, if we get in with him now, he'll be fine. And then YouTube algorithms changed again. And they stopped picking up the phone.
So now you're worthless because you're only at 800,000 subscribers, not a million.
Yeah. Literally, I think the only requirement for YouTube Red Show is you have to have good retention and you have to have 1 million subs. And then like from there, it's like negotiating and getting the right YouTuber in the right place. But
what does that do for you? Besides, obviously, they probably give you a payoff for producing the show. If most of your fans can't see it anyway, is that worth investing time into? I'm just thinking out loud now. If you got the opportunity to say, okay, we want you to do this YouTube Red show, even though we're not promoting YouTube Red, and you don't get a cut of signing people up to YouTube Red, we're gonna have you do the show. Is that sort of just cachet saying, oh, I'm a YouTuber that did a YouTube Red show? Is that what it really amounts to?
I think for me, right? I talked about it earlier about how I've been wanting YouTube was never the end game, it's always the means, and I've been wanting to move to the next platform to see what's there. And I've always wanted to make more content, more different content, more fun, diverse content. And I would have loved to have seen that avenue when a company gave me the proper funds to let me create what I want to create instead of me self-funding everything and not quite doing everything the way that I want to. Obviously, if you have a massive budget for a show or for a film or documentary, whatever you're working on, it's a different vibe because you have all this capital to make exactly what you want versus, oh, this is my own budget, which means it's coming out of my own pocket, which means I'm not going to spend the highest amount on the camera and the crew and the budget and all that stuff. So I would have loved to explore that possibility, but now I definitely have no interest.
Well, doesn't Patreon sort of fill that gap? Do you ever think about, I have a good show idea, let's see if people are interested enough to fund it from the outside?
Well, that's kind of what I did. I recently relaunched the Patreon back in August, and I did that. I said, hey, here's my show, Defend It. It used to be a show that I did all the time. And
I remember that, yeah.
And, you know, I need this minimum budget to make it, and people wanted to see it. And so now we've hit that goal, and actually it comes out, the first episode comes back next week. So that's kind of my way of doing it, I agree. I think Patreon and Game Wisp are great ways to create more content. But at the same time, it's kind of like going up. It's like taking a step forward and going a step back when you have things like demonetization claims going all across the board. Patreon and Game Wisp are great ways to empower the creator to have enough support and funding in the case that YouTube doesn't go well. But for us, it's never really been our crutch. It's been like we want to do more, you know, we want to make it bigger and better. And now, because of demonetization and how it's working in the algorithms, it's now becoming, oh, we're going to need to depend on Patreon and Game Wisp because the platform is starting to dry out.
But for one-off shows or new ideas, would you ever think about going to Kickstarter to do like a season? Say, okay, I want to fund 13 episodes of Defend It, and I know it's going to cost this amount of money to produce it. I'm going to ask for that amount and see if people want to do it. Is that something that appeals to you, or does that sort of scare you to use Kickstarter?
I'm a little scared to use Kickstarter. If I did do that, I'd want it to be a one-shot thing, like a film or like a almost like a mini-series where it's like there's this start, middle, and end. For serialized content, that's where I'd get nervous about because then you have the conversation of, oh, well, season two was good, but season three sucked. And I wasted my money because on season two, I felt like it was well spent. But season three, they really jumped the shark, you know? And it's like that stuff always bums me out. It's different when you're doing Kickstarters for things like DVD box sets because it's like, oh, I know this content. I already love it. I want to see more behind the scenes or more special stuff behind it. That's different than being like, I'm going to create a show that's 6 episodes or 12 episodes. And it works for celebrities who have producing companies, you know, things like Veronica Mars, when that came back, everyone was like, yeah, take my money. And with, with Nathan Fillion and, you know, and their show, the Comic-Con show, the con artist, whatever it's called, about the Comic-Con circuit. Like, again, prime example of how they did it right. It was like a short mini series situation, but serialized content to me is kind of a risk on Kickstarter. And I feel like, if I do use it for that, it's going to be for a film or a mini series where it's just
a one-time series, a one-time
thing. Yeah.
Sure. Pat and Gerard travel around the world show, something like that. we both need some time off, and we can do a travel log show. Perfect. That's the future of YouTube, travel logs.
There you go.
Let's do it.
There you go.
Let's talk a little bit about where we're going to be at in 10 years. I mean, we're almost at both of us, not the twilight of our YouTube years. We're in like the middle age, I want to say,
yeah,
of our YouTube years. And in 10 years from now, I try to ask this of various people. And some people say, I'll be doing the exactly same thing. Someone said, I probably won't be doing this anymore. I'll be doing something somewhat connected. Do you see yourself moving on to other projects, maybe being more behind the scenes, big Gerard producer guy with the gold chain walking around? Or do you see yourself in the same mode you are now, but maybe just expanded?
You know, I want to go to television and film. I want to expand. And whether that means making more gaming content or making actual true content that's different, I want to get off the platform and make things where people can see what I'm making on a larger scale. And, you know, do I want to win awards for things? That'd be great, only if the stuff's good. But I think that's where I want to go. I do want to go to television. I do want to go to film. I do want to be able to have what I create seen on the masses in a larger scale. And while I have that audience on YouTube right now, the platform does not let me expand upon it. I have to put in all the groundwork. I have to, like you said earlier, we are one man armies, even though we have teams helping us sometimes. We are our own PR firm. We are our own merch guy. We're our own advertising marketing thing. You know, like we do all that work. And it'd be nice to get off the platform and build bigger projects and bigger ships. I want to be able to one day have that clout where if someone comes to me and says, I want to make this cool cartoon, I want to make this cool film, I want to make a video game, and I go, all right, let me hear your pitch. And I like the pitch, and I go, great, I'm in. Let's make this. And, you know, the name Gerard Khalil actually has weight when it comes to producing that thing. We can get financiers or venture capitalists or anyone to come to the table because of who was involved. You know, when prime example of Game Grumps, right? Like, when Dan Harmon got involved with Good Game, immediately everyone was like, oh, shit. Creator of Rick and Morty and Community, working with the Game Grumps, working with Jesse Cox and Michelle Morrow. Those are three different pyramids of different people who don't really work together, coming together to create this one cool thing. And the weight of all three of them individually combining into one is like a huge synergy that's pretty freaking cool. And that's kind of what I want to try and aim for when hopefully one day when we get off the platform. If that ever happens.
We're not 75 years old still doing a one-a-week completionist video. So who knows? It'll be the completionist, the fourth generation. Woo! It'd be like Doctor Who. You just keep regenerating.
Just
the
kill me off and get someone else to take my spot.
I'll be the third completionist, regeneration for me. I'll be the old one.
You don't want that job.
You don't want that. It'll turn me gray. So maybe you're predicting some sort of future where, yeah, the YouTubers move on from just content creators to behind the scenes, creatively producing more, helping out. And like you said, synergies, going to Netflix, going to Amazon Prime, going to Hulu and producing stuff. Because like you said, it'd be great to do that with just TV directly or movies. But I think by and large, it hasn't worked out that way where YouTubers have done a sort of a seamless transition to those other mediums. Either like been one-off like movies or something that's kind of happened and sort of fallen off.
Yeah, it's because people don't understand how to, like, you know, I auditioned for a few shows to be hosts for on things that were on like Spike TV or now not Spike but Encore, whatever the frick that network's called nowadays. But yeah, people expect results right away. They expect the success to come out of it if you throw someone's YouTube name at a TV show. Like, I think Hannah Hart has her own cooking show right now on Food Network, and Grace Helbig had her own talk show on E! Or something like that. And it's like, these are massive YouTubers that nowadays don't pull the largest numbers that they used to. But it took them a while to get off the platform. And when they got off the platform, they're in that balance of my content and my audience is large and supportive, but not as it used to be because the platform has changed. And so, again, it's like a few steps forward, a couple steps back.
It's almost like you can't have a foot in both worlds.
Yeah.
It's almost like you have to just make a decision. Am I going to TV and movies? This is all behind. Like, this, it's going to be hard to be as competitive or keep up with what I was doing before.
Absolutely. You know?
Either treat it as a transition or not. I think a great example is someone like we both love Andre Meadows, and that I see him getting all these awesome hosting gigs, working for Sci-Fi, doing things here and there. But it's like the people hiring him. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn. It's like they don't care, or it's almost incidental that he has a YouTube following. He's obviously very talented, but they're not capitalizing on his YouTube channel and what he brings to that. It's almost like it's entirely separated. Whenever I see him on stage with these celebrities and these people, I always think to myself, Andre could be doing a hell of a lot more. This guy is a hell of a lot more talented and a lot funnier than what they're allowing him to do on that stage. That's what I always think when I see that. So it's almost like they're two different worlds that are almost just incidentally connected, at least at this point in time. That's how I'm seeing it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and, you know, it's like, I mean, I don't know about you, but when was the last time you've been to a GameStop? Like, when you go into GameStop nowadays, they have Kinda Funny, Game Attack, Screw Attack, Funhouse, and Rooster Teeth, Achievement Hunters on all their displays playing. And so you walk into a GameStop, and it's those personalities and those hosts talking about those games, doing Let's Plays, doing interviews. That's awesome. That's a means of showing the industry, hey, when you empower the community that's watching and creating content and a part of that community and is a part of the driving force as to why these games are selling and doing well, that's like giving the correct people the right keys to the right castle at the right time. But not everyone gets that. Not everyone understands that that is something that you should be doing. You know, I recently just shot an episode of Storage Wars.
Did you really?
I did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's coming out in October.
I have heat with one person on that show.
like actual beef?
Renee.
Were you on that show?
No, but I've known a handful of them from the swap meets.
Cool.
Daryl used to sell at my local swap meet. Dave Hester sells at this one sometimes, so I kind of know him. But Renee, the C-lister one from the show, I knew him well before he was on Storage. That's a whole other conversation. We won't get into that. So tell me about that experience. How did that happen?
So, ironically enough, through SoCal Retro Gaming Expo, they went on to the SoCal Retro Gaming Expo website and they went through all of the guests and tried to see who was Los Angeles local. And I was the only one that's actually a true LA native. And they were like, oh, let's go with him. And they researched me and they were like, oh, this guy's perfect. And they had me I didn't sign an NDA. I didn't sign anything about I didn't do any of that stuff. But they did ask me to not share what I appraised. So I can't say what I appraised.
But you're an appraiser.
But I'm an appraiser. So they came to appraise a video game for them, to appraise a thing.
A retro video game or something new?
Retro. Yeah.
They got you and not me. Now I'm jealous, damn it. Now I'm jealous. I know like three people on that show. Well, I'm looking forward to that. That sounds fantastic.
It was fun. They did it in like a few hours. It was really, really fun and cool. But I think my point is that like people aren't going to go out and buy a subscription to Storage Wars, right? They're not going to go out and buy like a cable network show that I cameoed on to appear. Yeah,
it's totally different audiences.
Absolutely,
obviously.
Absolutely.
I mean, the case in point. Sorry to cut you off.
No, go for it.
But Video Game Years, we actually tried pitching it to two pretty big locations. Actually, three. Two major gaming websites both said, when we did Video Game Years, this is too old for us. So we don't want it. This is like one website in particular said, this is what our viewer's older brother would watch. Like, we're like, what does that mean? No one's interested in video game history. But then we also pitched it to a major TV network. John D'Elia had connections back when he used to work with TV side. And he did the pitch. He showed him the video. We're talking, you know, corporate room. I wasn't there, but he was there. And he said, this is too young for us. This to have this as a TV series. So we're thinking, what's the little 5-year gap to where we can win then? Where TV, it's too young. You know, these major gaming websites is too old. It's weird, but it just shows the mentality of these TV execs that are totally separated, and this is why TV and cable is slowly dying, obviously, is that the TV audience is trending older, and the online content is younger, and there hasn't been someone to really come in and shake it up and connect both yet. It's been very difficult to marry the two.
There is a specific divide right now between old media trying to be new media and new media trying to be old media. And what you have in the center are the people who are creating all the content that's drawing the viewership from both. And it's this weird duality thing of people don't know how to bridge the gap. But it seems so simple. It seems so easy. If you are doing a cosplay show, obviously as Sci-Fi has done, you get cosplay professionals, which they've done. You know, if you're going to do a show about E.T. and Atari and all those, you know, the story about the company, the rise and fall, and the cartridges out in the desert, then probably should get some Atari experts who know all the ins and outs. But
sure.
People don't think of that. They think, who can we get the views? Let's get Snoop Dogg to play what is it? Star Wars Battlefront. Let's get Snoop Dogg. Let's get James Franco. Let's get whoever. I'm sure if they play the games, the kids will want to play the games with them. And it's like,
When I saw Ice-T playing a new game, I was just like, what? Do you think Ice-T's audience is going to... He's going to be selling games to, like, what? I couldn't square the two together. I think what's more telling is probably this, that, like, when you're on your, like, you're going to be on that reality show, I'll put reality in air quotes, and I'm on I was on Pawn Stars, can almost guarantee you that the casual viewer watching by chance, less than, like, 5%, 1% will say, hey, that's a guy from the internet. More people are going to see the clip of you re-uploaded on YouTube being on that show versus watching it on the TV show when it first comes out.
It's true. And I guarantee you, no matter, like, for Storage Wars specifically, I reached out to Jay and to Norm to make sure that, like, I had, like, when I was talking about the item, that I had, like, the proper, like, vernacular to make sure that, like, because here's the thing, my train of thought
What am I, chopped liver here? Come on! You couldn't reach out to me?
I could have, Pat, but I didn't want to bother you. But, yeah, it was one of those things where I wanted to, like, make sure that if someone who is watching this as a video gamer or a YouTube connoisseur, they're going to see this video and be like, oh, what he said is correct. What he said is right. And that was the biggest thing, is that I made them, like, re-roll several takes. I was like, I didn't say it right. I didn't pronounce it right. I didn't give the right information. And they'd be like, it doesn't matter. And I was like, no, but it does matter. It does matter. Sure. Because to everyone who's watching this video in TV land, they're going to see this and assume that I'm a fat neckbeard guy who doesn't know shit about shit, and that I'm just an idiot. But to everyone else out there who's watching, they're going to judge me way more. They want to make sure that I got everything correct what I'm talking about, and I actually know what I'm talking about. And that to me was the most important thing ever, was that what I was saying was true and that was representative of the gaming community. Because whether I like it or not, The gaming YouTube community and the collecting scene and the retro community scene is going to see these clips, and they're going to think I'm cringy. They're going to think I'm awful. They're going to think I'm the worst. But whatever the fuck I said is going to be exactly as it was intended through history and through the community.
I guarantee you it'll be a nice juicy CU podcast segment when we're on the show. But I got on the one Storage Wars person, Renee, who has taken shots at me in the past on Twitter and for whatever reason. I'm hoping it's not the one that visited you, by the way. But what I had a problem with is that when he found a huge storage locker games, he was pricing them out of thin air. Like, oh, those Atari 2600 games are $10 each. No, they're not. They're not $10 each. They're a dollar each, and you can't give away most of them. You know, like, so it creates a false sense of history for the time, because for some reason people think they see it on TV and it has more weight than YouTube, which doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? And so you have to present the facts correctly. So I'm glad that you reached out to Norm and Bill and Jay and not me to get your information. Now I'm never going to let this go until I die. I'm never going to let that go.
I'm sorry, Pat.
I'm never going to let that go. Do you see yourself as people? There's a negative and positive connotation to the word entrepreneur. Are you an entrepreneur?
Absolutely. I would say I am. I would say that I think if you run your own business, you're an entrepreneur, because I feel like you don't have anyone to report to but yourself. You're just it's just you. You made this thing, and whether you're making food or you're providing a service or you're making content or you're doing whatever, you are the business. That is who you are. You are someone who took the risk to create this thing. And the fact that you're still pioneering it, or you're still working through it, and you're working for many years looking to grow it and harness it and maintain it, that absolutely makes you an entrepreneur. It just depends whether or not people... I feel like entrepreneur nowadays is like... An entrepreneur to me, in like the tech sense that everyone wants to hear, is like, I've made 7 businesses and I've sold all of them. You know what I mean?
Philip DeFranco making these news organizations and selling them off one after another, you know, like that sort of thing. Right?
Yeah,
you build it up to sell it, you start another one and you sell it.
Yeah, and like that's like Tom Anderson from MySpace. He did it with MySpace, built up MySpace and sold it. You know, I'm sure.
Well, thank God he did, because you and your brother were destroying it. You're the reason it went under.
We're the reason why you all couldn't connect to your favorite MySpace page at 4 a.m.
You're the one that allowed everyone to do all their GIFs of snowflakes that would crash your browser because it couldn't load everything. Remember that crap?
Yeah.
You couldn't load some pages up. There was too much customization. Way too much. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about... We'll switch gears a little bit. Something that surprised me that I saw a YouTuber do, but I love that you did it, and I think it's important to talk about, especially in the age of, you know, online content and people sitting on their butts. You've made your health and fitness goals very public in the past, over a year, and got a personal trainer and have put some videos on YouTube sharing your journey. What prompted you to want to start doing that?
So I, when I started doing my weight and my health has been something that's been fluctuation since I was probably 15 or 16. I used to be the heaviest I've ever been in my entire life was 350 pounds. I used to be one of those really problem kids that was like really scared for their health. And it wasn't until I started playing DDR and started just like having a good growth spurt where I lost almost all that weight. And so when I was in high school, I was like really skinny, really in shape. I was exercising a lot. I was working on MySpace, obviously. And so like I had like a really crazy work ethic that would just fitness was not really a big deal to me. When I got to college, I put on those freshman 15 and I was still able to maintain it and keep it off for the most part. When I made the completionist, I saw this massive undertaking of a show that was making $0 for the first 2 years, that had no financial support, that didn't really have merch or convention runs. I was a one-man army that had some help on the side, and it was not going well in terms of my health. I would stay up, you know, I would literally stay up 26, 28 hours straight sometimes and get episodes done. And the whole allure of Man versus Show is very important to me. And I wanted to make sure that I did not miss a Friday. If I missed maybe two or three Fridays in my entire career, and those Fridays videos ended up becoming Monday videos. I did not want to walk away from that commitment. And as things developed and as things got bigger and scarier, my health was getting worse. And beginning of this year, I started getting panic attacks. I started getting a lot of anxiety, which is not really who I am because I'm a theater kid, right? So I'm used to talking and presenting and being in people's faces. And I used to sell games at Best Buy. So like I have a lot of retail experience engaging with customers. And that stuff never really scared me or bothered me. But there were a couple conventions in 2016 where I had genuine panic attacks where – and I didn't know what was going on because I'm sitting here going like, what the hell? Like this isn't normal. And – I went and saw the doctor, and I was 310 pounds. My blood sugar was really bad. My carbohydrates were really bad. My dad has type 2 diabetes, and he had a quadruple bypass heart surgery and has high blood pressure. And I'm 29, you know? I turned 29, and I saw all of this, and I was like, this is the end for me. Like, I'm killing myself doing this. I need to make a active lifestyle change. And so given that YouTube is kind of in its downswing in January, February, March until April, I decided to make a big change. And so I wanted to make myself committed to my audience to make sure that like they are the ones that can hold me accountable for not committing to it. And so I made this show called Buff Boys, and it's literally it is a reality show. What you see is real. None of it is
not
like,
assisted.
Like none of it is. It's just us talking off the cuff, just how you and I are right now, and a lot of vomiting and throwing up in the early episodes. But I in 3.5 months I went from 310 pounds to about 260, and
wow.
Now as of today I think I'm 245, 250. And that was I would have lost more, but traveling and maintaining. I mean, you were with me in Norway. I was in that gym. I was putting in that work and running on the treadmill and stuff. But not every hotel across the planet has a good gym situation, and it's hard to eat healthy without being sensible sometimes with, you know, airplane food and whatnot. But I made it a big goal of mine to change my life, and I've been doing it ever since. And I'll tell you what, I don't care about how many views and subscribers I have anymore so much as I'm happy. And I think that's the big thing for me this year is trying to make myself physically, mentally, and emotionally happy with what I'm doing.
Well, I believe in sort of a holism of the body affects the mind, affects the body. So
yeah.
If you feel better physically, mentally you feel better. And there is a little bit of science behind that, but it's just, to me, common sense that if you're not feeling physically run down, you have more energy because you're in better shape – mentally, you're going to feel better.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just common sense. And maybe you've seen that so far. So you're saying in high school, you weighed 350 pounds about?
It wasn't high school so much. It was like middle school. In middle school, I was like 13, 14. So
you weighed 350, and you went and you dropped down to a normal weight.
Yeah, when I turned about 15, 16 years old, I recalibrated. That's why I have a lot of stretch marks on my abs, from that massive growth spurt. That I received in the 2 years.
That's a huge growth spurt. To wow, that's
yeah. But
you're about what? You're my height or you're like 5'10"?
No, I'm 5'7", 5'8".
5'8", okay. So wow, 5'8", 350 at 14 years old. Yeah, wow. So this was obviously the history of your family having issues. So that kind of I guess scares you a little bit. You don't want to end up there. Type 2 diabetes, to potentially developing that as an adult. But then obviously you're feeling better as you've been working out, eating a little healthier. Is it also encouraging to see the response from people seeing your progress?
It's been crazy, crazy infectious with the amount of support I've received. I get tweets every day about people who joined me on my journey and they've lost 80 pounds, 90 pounds, 100 pounds, and I'm so proud of those people who do it. And it's so, you know, at first I was so concerned, like, it's going to be so hard, but, like, it really isn't. It's just simple. You have to take the time and make the time. And I think once I realized that, it made everything hard in everyone else because, like, deadlines were based on my, like, I feel bad. I come to work today or really any day. And it's like, all right, guys, we're going to film from 12 to 3. And it's like, oh, wait, no, we can't because Gerard's at the gym. Like, we can't because Gerard's at the doctor. We can't because Gerard's at the dentist. Like, we can't do these things because the one guy who's running our company is going to miss this important event. And so, but everyone...
It's not a crappy podcast. Can't do it.
But I think because everyone is so supportive in my company, let alone in my audience, that it's been a game changer for me. It really has been. I used to snore bad and have real bad sleep apnea. That's all gone now. And like, I don't know. Was I snoring in your room, Pat, when we were sleeping in the same room?
I was so out of it. I probably didn't even notice, to be honest. That the Norway trip takes so much out of me. Probably you two were coming from the West Coast.
Yeah.
That it takes me a good week to recover from it. It's really rough.
Yeah, yeah.
Not woe is me. I'm going to Norway. But it physically, the jet lag and everything. And plus the fact that in Norway, the sun's down for only 3 hours a day.
That is that's the scariest part.
That's 11:30 at night. The sun's still out. And you're like, what the hell time is it?
Yeah.
Like, it's bizarre. But that screws with your cycle as well to sleep. So you've inspired other people, which is good. I think Penn Jillette has done something similar because he wrote a book about Penn Jillette lost about 100 or 150 pounds.
Yeah.
Looks totally different. And people tweeted him, hey, I lost 50 pounds. I lost 75 pounds. And I think it's nice to have, at least for me, in terms of losing weight, you don't have the best role models when you turn on TV, because usually those people are like ripped and in shape and they're you know, like, oh, buy this video, you can be like me. And they're professional models. They've been in shape for 15, 20 years. They were never probably extremely overweight. They were just always toned and ripped, you know, and got into it for the most part. So I think it's good to have people be able to provide people to identify with to others if they have their own struggles, or hey, listen, if Gerard can get into better shape, if Pat can do it, then I can do it. It's not that difficult. And that's what I like about that.
Thank you very much. I'll tell you one thing that I never forget about, which is what's helped me stay motivated, is in like year two of the completionist, like when the completionist turned 1 year old, I did YouTube full time for 14 months without having any income. And after 14 months, my dad was like, you have to get a job. You can't do this part time. You have to do it. You know, you have to get a real job. So I worked for Beachbody, the guys who made a P90X and that stuff. I was an editor for them. I was working on a secret project that never came to light. And I don't know what I can say about the project, but I'll tell you, one of the things it involved large people losing weight, and like in a documentary style situation. And one of the things that I'll never forget is my job was to ingest footage, label it, convert it from regular to ProRes for the editors in the editing room, and then go from there with notes. And one of my final tasks before I got fired or let go because the project got canned was I had to watch all the testimonials. And you saw a lot of large people crying and tearing up and having a hard time with the workouts, with the dieting and stuff. But what was the most fascinating and the thing that I'll never forget was what they would do in between the takes. Because the camera guys had all their equipment set up and everything's rolling and they'd look away or change batteries or whatnot. And you would see these poor people reaching off camera and grabbing a hot dog and then eating it in one gulp or French fries or donuts. And they would, you could see they were a slave to their own health. They were in this show or in this presentation of losing weight, trying to be better. And they were so kind of enthralled and stuck into their ways of sugar carbs and that sugar style that they would just sneak in junk food in every shot. And I, one of my jobs was to report every single time that they ate food. And I counted well over 100 times where they'd be eating in between takes. They would be eating, like, it was rough to see because it's like, fuck the reality show aspect. Fuck the editing. You're watching people mentally struggle with their demons. And that to me is something that was so important going into this, was like, I can't be that. I can't give into that. I have to commit to this because my life is so important to me and it should be for everyone.
Sure. We want to see you around forever. I'll just say this. I think one of the, while obviously any sort of addiction, you have to have some sort of empathy for. I always argue that being addicted to food or overeating is one of the toughest because you have to eat. You don't have to gamble. You don't have to drink alcohol to survive.
You don't have to smoke cigarettes.
You don't have to have sex constantly to survive. Well, I don't know. But but for eating, you can't give up eating. So you think about if, like, okay, you're a drug user. Yeah, you go cold turkey, but you don't have to survive doing that line of coke the next week. You still have to eat. So to me, that's why I always have a lot more empathy, at least, for people that struggle with overeating, because it's not like you can go cold turkey on eating. You just, you have to retrain your mind about what you need and give up what you don't and be smart about it. And that's a lot harder, I think, than some people realize when you're looking at it from the outside. If you haven't been through it like we have, it's a little more difficult to realize, to get to that point where, like, oh my God, I'm eating half the amount of food I used to and I'm full. Like, what's going on? Like, your whole body chemistry changes.
Yeah.
All the endorphins and triggers and things in your brain changes. You're literally rechanging your body's chemistry slowly and gradually. It's really interesting when you look at something like that. But I'm glad you're going through it, and I'm really proud of what you've done.
Thank you.
I really am.
Thank you very much.
I know, especially since your extreme schedule makes it tougher. But for those out there, you know, you don't have to work out every day. If you're just starting off, you know, 20 minutes, three days a week, start little and you build. That's really all it is.
Half an hour on the treadmill will do wonders. Just even a half an hour on the treadmill, just walking in place. And if you're bored, you have your Switch, you have your Wii U, like, throw it in there with you and do it. It's so simple. It's so simple.
Get one of those standing desks, and, you know, you can walk in places.
Yo, my dad has that in his office. He has a standing desk with his laptop and the treadmill underneath it, and that's
there you go.
That is a great way to do it. Working out sucks. It's so hard. It sucks. It sucks. It sucks. But, like, it's gonna get better, and you're gonna enjoy it.
I was gonna say, eventually, no, it sucks at the beginning. I can tell you, I wish we had more time. I could talk about how hellacious it was in college when I started running.
Yeah.
And how I felt like I was going to die for the first 3 weeks. But eventually it actually gets fun once you get it into your schedule.
Yeah.
Gerard, I'm running out of sometimes I run out of time versus a guest. What do you have going on in the future besides your nice Storage Wars appearance where you didn't bother to call me?
Pat, you're never going to let this down. I'm so sorry.
I'm not petty at all. Not at all.
What do I got going on? The new episodes of the redone 120 episodes of The Completionist start airing in October.
You're a nut.
I'm crazy. I'm insane. But and the big thing that people don't really realize is that I'm not making the same videos. I'm not going to, like, rehash the old content. It's just going to be more about, has my opinion changed about this game since 5+ years ago? And really, you know, are there any stories or memories I created while working on those episodes and things like that? So it's going to be very different. Other than that, I got a lot of secret stuff in the works, but nothing too crazy, nothing concrete. Just working on The Completionist and Defend It and my Let's Play channel and keeping the office going as much as we can.
Where can everyone find you on Twitter and on YouTube and on Twitch and wherever else you are?
Oh, man. That One Video Gamer, THATONEVIDEOGAMER. That's my moniker everywhere, on YouTube, on Twitch. And then everything else is just The Completionist or Gerard the Completionist. And a lot of people don't know how to spell or say my name correctly. So I'm sure if you just Google The Completionist, you'll find anything and everything you need to know. But yeah, that's where I'm at. Pat, thank you for having me, man. This was a lot of fun.
No, thanks. Thanks. And there's actually a ton of stuff that I wanted to get to that we did. And so we'll have to do this again in the future.
Yeah.
And thanks for potentially – well, again, thanks for helping out with last year's NES Marathon. You were a lifesaver. And maybe potentially this year's charity marathon again. We'll see. Announcement coming in the near future about that.
Yeah, stay tuned for that.
Thanks a lot, Gerard, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks again to Gerard for speaking to me. Let me tell you about That's It Fruit and Veggie Bars. You know That's It Fruit Bars. Ian and I have spoke about them on the podcast. I still don't know how they work. There's only fruit in here. Apple and strawberry, apple and mango, apple and coconut. Well, now they have That's It Veggie Bars. A little bit different, right? So these are, in my mind, a more healthy version or a healthier version of a granola bar, but you have veggies in here and bean combinations. So my favorites are black beans and peas. There's black beans and corn, black beans and carrots, and they're healthy, 90 calories each about. It's non-GMO. There's no additives in there. There's no preservatives in there. It's gluten-free. They're tasty. They're tasty. It's a light snack on the go. Throw it in your car or your little knapsack or your purse. Or do people still have fanny packs? Whatever. The whole point is that it's a nice, healthy snack, and it won't weigh you down, and it feels good. It feels good to eat something healthy every now and then, right? Go to thatsitfruit.com and enter code NOTCOMMON and save 10% on any order today. Again, it's under 100 calories, 4 grams of veggie protein, great source of fiber, non-GMO, no preservatives, no fat, gluten-free. Use it for a snack, for a treat. You won't feel guilty at midnight like me sometimes grabbing one of these. Again, go to thatsitfruit.com and use code NOTCOMMON to save 10%. Thanks for sponsoring the Not So Common podcast. So if you enjoyed this Not So Common podcast, please subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, or whatever you use to listen to them. You can rate the podcast, or please leave a comment and let others know on social media how much you enjoy it. Finally, if you want to help directly support me, check out my Patreon at patreon.com/patcontry. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.